So the subject of this particular talk is fundamental questions for ethical decision making. So I thought it would be helpful to begin by appealing to experience. In my last assignment, we would rotate among the priests in the rectory a duty line. So at any time, day or night, you could call St. Louis Bertrand, press 5, and be routed to whosoever cell phone was kind of ordained for the day. And as you might imagine, we got a lot of wild, wonderful, and interesting questions. And for the most part, it was used for the express purpose intended, namely for the scheduling of funerals on weekends and for those who needed a visit at the hospital. But every once in a while, you would just get the casual inquirer. So they would hear a message. It was like, blah, 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 blah. Talk to a priest, press 5. They're like, okay. in fielding those questions, I often received interesting queries. One of which was, it was on a Friday, a gentleman called and said, so the river's flooding, right? And I work for an engineering firm. We're filling sandbags, and it's tough. You know, it's very taxing. He said, it also happens to be Lent, and I'd prefer not to abstain from meat. Is this a legitimate way to kind of navigate my way around abstinence? I was like, okay, fascinating question. It's very, like, well-parsed and thought out. Another one, this is great. In the month of December, you may recall that Christmas fell on a Monday this year. At St. Louis Bertrand, we have a 5:15 Mass, so naturally all double dippers had to know. And we got many calls to the effect of, if I come to the 5:15, does that count for both my Sunday obligation and my Christmas obligation? Which, as you might imagine, is the best way to welcome the newborn king, by double dipping, you know? But then, you know, not to be flippant, but you get more kind of existential and urgent questions. So let's say my brother is a baptized Catholic, but he's ceased the practice of the faith, and he's planning to get married in Florida. And I saw the program, and the first reading is from Wuthering Heights, and the second reading is from Game of Thrones. And I just don't know whether or not I can attend. What is more, I don't know if I can be his best man. What is more, I don't know if I should bring my family. And so, here you have a kind of set of questions, all of which begin with the premise, is it permissible, or is it forbidden? Now, I posit to you that these are completely legitimate questions to ask, but they don't necessarily get at the heart of what is concerned in the moral life or ethical decision-making writ large, because they tend to approach the matter in reductionistic terms. Again, this is not to vilify those who pose them, because they are often deeply felt and urgent. But it's often the task of counselors, ministers, priests to broaden the horizon and introduce those concerned into bigger, bolder, and yet more beautiful concerns. So I would suggest that what we see often in praxis is a tendency towards ethical moralism. You've heard the word moralism trotted out and excoriated in a variety of contents, but I think we can parse it basically as a reduction of ethical decision-making to a series of do's and don'ts. There are things that you can and things that you can't. And it's often posed in terms of just these things, so whether it is forbidden or whether it is permissible. I would pose to you that it's healthier and happier to ask these questions in terms of what is true and in terms of what is good, in general, and for me. So, reorienting our vocabulary and grammar actually goes a long way into reorienting our conceptuality, the way that we envision or imagine and ask these questions, and so prosecute the discipline of ethical decision-making. Now, how, you might ask, does this pertain to bioethics? Well, I suggest again that bioethics, depending on how it is practiced, can sometimes fall prey to just this reduction. And it has in the past in certain contexts. I'm not calling anyone out in particular, but you can observe depending on the manuals that you read. So that the temptation often is just to want the answers. I just want to look at the back of the book, even if it only contains the answers to the odd-numbered questions. That at least is half. So there's a temptation to just want the answers and to know what is permissible and what is not, so that way I can be done with this very grisly process. So you just start from the understanding, okay, what's the difference between salpingectomy and salpingostomy, and which is forbidden and which is permitted, and how can I do it soon, now, presently, immediately? So I would suggest that even when inquiry begins or proceeds through a kind of action theory, it may still be reductive in scope. And you see these very vexed debates in the present context as to what constitutes an object and what constitutes an end. But ultimately, in a lot of these cases, it's just a matter of what I can do now. So what I propose to do just in the next few minutes, I'll speak in total for about 35 minutes and we'll leave about 5 to 10 minutes for questions, is to come at the problem obliquely. I think a good optic for examination is to discuss and consider the ascendancy of conscience as a principle of moral discourse and as a kind of corollary feature to see how it tracks with ethical moralism. Again, I'm not saying that conscience is bad. It assumes its place within the moral life, but it's not everything. And in turn, an over-reliance upon conscience as that sole operative principle in ethical decision-making will tend to overshadow more traditional principles which ought to be reclaimed. And here, in kind of quintessential Dominican fashion, I'm going to gesture awesomely and adamantly at the virtues as more immediately concerned in the making of a good person to act well. So, mode of proceeding. First, I'll examine the nature of conscience as a way to show that it has a role, but a subordinate role in ethics. And then I'll show how conscience is relative specifically to prudence as the virtue governing right practical reason. And then in so doing, I will suggest that an appeal to the virtue tradition more broadly is necessary to reclaim certain lost elements in ethical discourse. And, again, in all this, I will rely heavily and almost unexaminedly on St. Thomas Aquinas. Because you can do that when you're part of the same family, you know? So I will take that as my prerogative, and I'll do no throat clearing as to why he is worthy, okay? CF Eterna Patris, okay. So first, the ascendancy of conscience. So when most are asked, kind of the man on the street is asked, what the most pertinent principle, like how do you make a decision as of or pertaining to bioethics? What's at stake? How does that hit you? How does that actually register? I suspect that many people would say it's a matter of conscience. You should do what conscience dictates, or you should follow your conscience. And in the last 150 years, specifically, of ecclesial life, there have been a number of luminary witnesses who have highlighted for us what conscience consists in and how it is an essential feature of life. So you can think here, of course, John Henry Newman is quoted to this effect with great, you know, with great power. And Joseph Ratzinger has weighed in his own way. And even in present American constitutional jurisprudence, the feature of conscience has, you know, there's like this apotheosis of conscience as the thing under which we get whatever it is that we want. Now, how has this come to be? Here, there's a temptation to do a kind of intellectual genealogy, but I am incompetent to do such things, so I will not venture a guess. But I can kind of gesture vaguely and then leave the situation. So you can track certain historical factors that may or may not have contributed to this fact. So you can think of upheaval within the world of religion, specifically those attendant upon the Reformation, the wars that followed, the discovery of the New World, and then the kind of privatization of faith that's happened in our own country. But you can also track some of these things in continental philosophy with its insistence upon the thinking subject, somewhat divorced from or immune to the external world. But the thing that I suppose is most illuminating in that about which I've studied is the actual tradition of Catholic moral theology and the jurisprudence that follows from it. So you may have heard of a theory of ethical thought called probabilism, right? Maybe? No? Okay. So probabilism, yes. People are fist pumping in the back. Not for probabilism, but in recognition thereof. Right. So probabilism is a system whereby one can render ethical decisions and move from a kind of subjective uncertainty to a practical certainty. Again, the point is to move from the experience of doubt to a kind of certainty in action, to move from doubt to action. And we see this arise especially during that period referred to as the Second Scholasticism. So you may recall that St. Thomas Aquinas lived about 1225 to 1274, and that when he died, there were condemnations leveled against him in both Oxford and in Paris for things associated with Latin of Averroism, which is not important for present purposes, but that he was only subsequently vindicated in part by the efforts of Dominican friars and then canonized in the 1320s. But it wasn't like a continuous history of Thomistic thought that followed between his death and the 16th century. Rather, people just kind of continued to do what they did. So the textbook in university formation was the sentences of Peter Lombard, and people continued to comment upon them all the way up to the 16th century. And it wasn't until the late 15th century that a variety of men, Conrad Cullen in Germany, Peter de Chanel in France, Cardinal Cajetan in Italy, and then Francisco de Vitoria in Spain, who began substituting the Summa Theologiae, St. Thomas's big book of theology, for the sentences of Peter Lombard. So at this time, there was a kind of revivification of Thomistic thought, and there was a great excitement for it. And with the discovery of the New World, a lot of ethical decisions were being made in conversation with the work of St. Thomas. And you can think here simply of the fact that Francisco de Vitoria is hailed as the founder of international rights, or at least he's memorialized outside of the UN for such reasons. So it's during this time, and specifically at the School of Salamanca, where Francisco de Vitoria taught from 1526 to 1546, that we see this come about. And the men who did it were self-consciously expositors of St. Thomas Aquinas. So the classical kind of definition of probabilism comes from Bartolomeo de Medina, who is himself commenting on question 19, article 5 and 6 of the Prima Secunda of the Summa Theologiae. So it's not like, as a Dominican, I'm not just like washing my hands of probabilism. I realize that it's part of my DNA. But I am going to criticize it. So Bartolomeo de Medina was a student of Francisco de Vitoria, and you can find some of this stuff in a tradition just one generation before him. But what is probabilism? Okay, basically, you start with the experience of doubt regarding a moral decision to be taken. Doubt regarding a moral decision to be taken. So whether or not it is permissible or possible, say for a confessor, to absolve someone contrary to his own opinion. And in order to make that decision, you range yourself on a spectrum between the safer position, namely that which favors the law, and then the less safe position, namely that which favors freedom. And then you arrange probable opinions on both sides. So you would go and mine the scriptures, you'd go and mine the fathers, you would go and mine medievals, and then current philosophers and theologians teaching in the university, what the magisterium has declared on such things, and you would assemble probable opinions. And then you have a kind of reflex principle. If I can find 5 to 6 on the side of liberty, then I can take it. That's the kind of classical expression of probabilism. But as you might imagine, people had differing opinions. So you may have heard of laxism. Laxism was the thought that if you have any probable opinion on the side of freedom, go for it. It's just like party on, right? And then you have rigorism on the other side, which says you basically need all of the probable opinions to be ranged on the side of freedom in order to loose you. But then in between these options, you have a variety of different opinions. So there's probabilism that says, if there's a probable opinion or a few probable opinions on the side of freedom, you go for it. There's probabiliarism, which says, it's got to be more probable in order for you to follow. And then in the middle, there's equiprobabilism, which was given to us by St. Alphonsus Liguori, and one of the reasons that he's actually hailed as the patron saint of moral theologians and made a doctor of the church. So the big question here is what binds and what looses. And the way that you begin to ask is it permissible or is it forbidden? And you appeal to authorities. So you can see how this is immediately pertinent to our present situation. What happens, though, is a kind of transposition in the teaching of Christian ethics. So there are commentators of the 20th century who love to point to the way that moral treatises slowly evolve in a way that they would argue is really not good. So if you've ever read Servais Pinkers' The Source of Christian Ethics, he just does a study of tables of contents. How many pages are devoted to this and how many pages are devoted to that? So for instance, if you read the first part of the second part of St. Thomas's Summa, you've got all of these things that just sound great. So you start with 5 questions devoted to beatitude. Yes. And then you have another 16 questions devoted to human action. And then you have another 27 questions devoted to passions. And then another few questions devoted to habits, virtues, vices, law, and grace. So you're beginning with the question of what is good, what is happy. And then you proceed through those operative principles which make us good, namely virtues. And you're also attending to the gifts of the Holy Spirit and to the fruits of the Holy Spirit, to the law, both given in the Old and New Testament, impressed upon us in the natural law, in God, in the eternal law, and also to grace, that most excellent of exterior helps, which does in us what we cannot. When you get to the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, this is shifted, the main way in which moral theology is arranged is according to freedom, law, conscience, cases of conscience, and sin. So, we've already shifted our emphasis, and it portends poorly for the moral discourse, because you can see how you're already within a system that presumes certain things as important. So that's the first, the ascendancy of conscience. That's a kind of little genealogy of it as it plays out in the Christian moral tradition. Second, let's attend to what conscience is in itself. I realize this is vexed and highly opinionated, but again, I'm going to appeal to St. Thomas Aquinas, so try and stop me. Okay. So what does conscience mean before its transposition? How do we see it on offer in St. Thomas Aquinas in a kind of classical expression? Conscience means to know with. So conscientia. It's like knowledge with. It's a knowledge that accompanies a judgment. And it's always gestured to, or it's always indicated, as an instrument of ethical knowledge. So it's not a separate faculty. It's an instrument. What is happening is one is applying knowledge to some concrete act. So, in the broadest sense, consciousness just means to be aware of something, right? But then, conscience, as we typically use it, means the application of moral knowledge to something either before or after the act happens. It's the way that we process whether or not it's good. Mind you, conscience is not something that we know, but it's something by which we know. It is a tool, not a thing. So specifically, it's an act of judgment. You recall from Dr. Rambera's course that there are three acts of the mind. Apprehension, whereby that which out there exists comes to take up residence in me. And then judgment, when I begin to compare. And then reasoning, when I play out the implications thereof. So it's a judgment of whether or not this thing perceived corresponds to something else. So it departs from knowledge, and it returns to knowledge. You can think about it as a kind of sifting of knowledge. How is it that I sort out what I know and compare it to what is out there? And it's often described in the form of a syllogism. I realize syllogisms aren't the most compelling of arguments to make, but just for your kind of complete knowledge thereof. Here we go. So you take a major, a minor, and then you draw a conclusion. The major is taken from those precepts of natural law which live in us at the level of both knowledge and inclination. So Dr. Rambera gestured towards that first principle, which is good is to be done and evil is to be avoided. Now, that doesn't seem eminently practicable, because what does that mean in the concrete? So those things, those principles get played out with greater and greater specificity. And the Ten Commandments are an expression of the first principles of practical reason, more concretely expressed. So you start with a major premise, like, for instance, nothing contrary to the law of God should be done. And then you take a minor premise. The minor premise is gathered from an actual engagement with the world. You're perceiving something out there and making a judgment regarding it. So this concrete act at stake would be contrary to the law of God. So that's something that you gain from moral knowledge. And then from those two premises, you draw the conclusion that one should abstain from this concrete act. So you shouldn't do things contrary to the law of God. This would be contrary to the law of God. This shouldn't be done. That's a basic sketch of a judgment of conscience. And so, what you do is you begin with the first principles of the natural law. You take something about the world that you observe, a kind of concrete knowledge of the moral situation. And what that does is it informs your moral repository of judgments. You have an ever-growing knowledge of what should and should not be done. So a couple notes about conscience that we can observe from this basic sketch. First, it is not immediately practicable. That doesn't make the most of sense at the outset, but you can appreciate what this means. That's not something that issues in action. That judgment is something that we can make from a kind of distance. It doesn't implicate me immediately in the moral situation. I can be in an ivory tower or in a Dominican priory and look down at my nose whilst making judgments of conscience. I don't actually have to be in the ring. I don't actually have to be in the Colosseum waging, as it were. That's a judgment I can make from my desk, which is my favorite place from which to make judgments. Okay. So you can also see that it doesn't regard agency. It's not something of a person in motion. St. Thomas says that it applies to pure cognition, de pura cognizione. It's something mental, which isn't to say not real. It's just to say that it's knowledge. So it pertains to a habit of our intellect. It pertains to a habit of our speculative intellect, as some would argue, though that's a contentious claim. Second, conscience can err. We know that. So you can make false judgments of conscience. In the sense that you can misperceive the situation, you've actually misjudged what this action is out there in the world, or you can reason incorrectly. So something can cause that process to derail, either under the sway of passion or some kind of cognitive distortion. So I can be wrong and I can judge wrong, which is to say that conscience can be wrong. Third and final note is that conscience, I'm just going to gesture back towards the Summa, has only a very low-grade relative importance in St. Thomas's understanding. So for instance, the Summa is very large, right? Many questions and many articles within said questions. If you were to guess how many articles are devoted to conscience, you might think like, I don't know, Baker's dozen. False. There are four. There are four articles devoted to conscience. So it comes up in his discussion of human nature in the first part. It comes up in his discussion of whether conscience binds and looses in the Prima Secunda, and then it comes up again in the Treatise on Prudence. But it's all just in passing. It's all just in passing. So he doesn't devote much consideration or expend himself in that way. Okay, that's our setup. Now we're going to shift into the third and final point concerning prudence. And the point for this is just to show that an exaltation of conscience represents a departure from what is a more coherent ethical tradition, which stresses the virtues, which stresses those things that make us good, and that we can actually recover these both in counsel and instruction and in practice. So, before we begin talking about prudence, just a small terminological point. When you hear prudence, you might think of George Bush declaring whether or not it would be prudent to expend monetary resources in the waging of a foreign war. It's like, that might not be prudent. So we think about prudent often in a debased way. It's a kind of shrewd judgment whereby we distance ourselves from something dubious. But it doesn't have the same ring that it may have had in the 13th century. And you can actually see this in a variety of Christian virtues, which is dispiriting, but it's something that we need to be conscious of so that we can work against it. You can think of temperance. So temperance is this incredible virtue which makes us good with respect to the passions. So we have a kind of unruly spirit that is just burgeoning with life and wants what is good, and yet our instincts are somewhat disordered. And so they need to be rectified vis-a-vis reason. We need to be like in good relation to what actually builds up our bodily life. And that's awesome that it's actually possible. You can look at what's out there and desire a right. And yet what do we think about when we hear temperance? Don't drink. Right? It's just a heartbreaking reduction. The same thing is at work, too, with charity. How do we often hear charity posed? Well, he's a charity case. You know, to be the object of charity, because the object of almsgiving or material need, is something to be despised. It's something that we shirk or otherwise, you know, just distance ourselves from. But charity, to love God with his own love and to love our neighbor with the same, whereby we can actually live in a divine ambiance. We can actually enjoy communion here, which fructifies in heaven. It's like, dang, son, that's incredible, right? But what do we think about it as? A kind of low-grade, condescending almsgiving. Blah. Okay, so prudence. Don't think about it just as shrewdness with respect to monetary affairs. It's something far bigger and far more beautiful in the Christian tradition. And just three small things about prudence, and then we'll take questions. So first, prudence is a virtue, virtus, taken from the root vir. So it's like strength, associated with masculinity. And you can date back to the Homeric tradition, where virtue was like doing your battlefield duty. Bear up, heart. Thou hast endured worse than this. So it's something that makes it so that you can do that which you were made for, with a kind of constancy, with a kind of stability, with a kind of excellence, which shows what it means to be what you are in the utmost. And here, virtue dialogues with our desire in an excellent way. So virtue heals, elevates, orders, and emboldens our love. A lot of times we think about, again, with respect to temperance, we think about virtue as deadening those desires which we can't otherwise control, right? It's a matter of like, yikes, I want too much, therefore I should be virtuous, so that way I can be satisfied with just doing my job and showing up on time. It's like, no. when asked, you know, do we desire too much or too little? We desire too little. Because love, in the kind of classical understanding, is that power whereby we are engaged in life. If we didn't love, we would never move. We would lack even the integrity to push watch next episode on Netflix, right? Even that takes a kind of low-grade love. Because love is just the recognition that there's something out there which makes me whole. That I am made on the way and not at the end. And until such time as I am, I will always tend, incline towards the assimilation, the acquisition, the building up of what's out here. And love is just that recognition in the kind of base, emotional or passionate sense. But it has higher resonances. So it's taken up into our rational lives and becomes a key component in making us good. So virtue draws out what is good in desire and purifies what is bad. This is a... you just don't hear that. You just don't hear that. Which is mind-boggling and hopefully going to change. So when we think about virtue, the kind of classic Aristotelian definition is that virtue is what makes a man good and to act well. So it makes one good and to act well. That is to say, it changes us in this kind of wild interior manifold in such a way that we can reliably do what it is that we want. And when you pick this up in the Christian tradition, it will either be, you know, a kind of acquired excellence through the repetition of good things, repetition of good actions, or an infused one that God himself gives, he does in us, without us. And what these things do is that they actually incline us, they make it so that we actually desire what is good for us concretely, and they give us an appetite for perfection that is progressively more and more clarified. Now, think of this point with respect to what we've said before in conscience. The moral systems that grow up in the 16th century and beyond, namely probabilism and its brothers and sisters, they focus principally on error and on fallibility and how to move from speculative incertitude to practical certitude. So you begin with the experience that there are different things that are possible, and I want to have the certitude that when I make a choice, I won't endanger myself. So you begin from the outset with more so psychological concerns. It's kind of an interior battle. Yes, it's with respect to things out there, but what you want is security. Or, in the other case, what you want is freedom. So it's principally in terms of autonomy or the binding thereof. It's not so much this objective dialogue with things which build me up. So virtue focuses on the good. It puts us in dialogue with what is out there, for us, addressed to us for the building up of our lives and loves. So in the case of a rigorist, the principal consideration is security. In the case of a laxist, the principal consideration is freedom and how to attain to it. But with the prudential course, the principal consideration is truth. What is true? Because truth serves only its slaves, and that's a bondage to be preferred to all else. So that's the first. Prudence as virtue. Second, prudence is governing. So prudence does work which conscience cannot. St. Thomas talks about prudence as recta ratio agibilium. It's right reason with respect to things to be done. So it actually infuses our actions with reason so that you can look at a prudent agent and say that person is wise and good and prudent. You can actually see it in a kind of verifiable way, not subject to the same kind of tests as, you know, particular to the scientific method. But still, you can recognize it. You can recognize that kind of moral virtuosity. And what prudence does is it actually orchestrates the movements of the lower virtues. So typically, and since Aristotle and Cicero, you talk about four cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. Temperance orders us with respect to our baser passions, the concupiscible passions, which is just like, those ones. And then the irascible appetite is informed by fortitude. This is principally with respect to hope and fear. So not only is this thing delicious, but also it's difficult to get to. Like it's on the other side of a portcullis with, you know, archers with flaming arrows. Do I want it that much? Okay? If it's like soft batch cookies, is it worth this endeavor? Fortitude steels you against such difficulties. And then justice is actually rectifying your appetite with respect to other people, to render to another what is due. And prudence has a governing role with respect to these lower virtues, in that it marshals them for the sake of an integral whole. So these things actually give you your ends. They clarify for you what we're made for the preservation of bodily life, for the procreation and education of children, for living in society and knowing God, shunning ignorance, right, and trying to avoid offending those with whom we live. These are all provided by the moral virtues, or provided by the ends thereof. And then prudence dictates how we navigate means on the way to those ends, right? So prudence has this kind of governing capacity to make sense, to make whole what is otherwise dispersed. Because oftentimes those who lack virtue experience an acute form of dissipation, to be distracted from distraction by distraction. But prudence makes one entire. And so prudence also will operate at the level of both cognition, that is thought, and then inclination, appetite, volition. So it's a moral virtue, which we associate with the will in a kind of extended sense, but it's also an intellectual virtue. It informs our practical knowledge, our practical intellect, specifically intellect with respect to things to be done, as opposed to speculative, which is with things to be known and delighted in themselves, and to devote your vocation to considering. Right. So what prudence does is that it moves in both the spheres of intellect and will, because there's a recognition that those are inextricably bound up. There's an oft-cited Aristotelian dictum, as the man is, so he sees. Basically, what you love and how you pursue those loves will make it more or less possible for you to judge reasonably. So if I'm a soft-batch cookie slave, then I may not necessarily be prudent in the face of some difficulty or some, you know, judicial trial, or in the case of some whatever that concerns me being separated from soft-batch cookies, right? To bring back the aforementioned river with somebody drowning passing. So I have these soft-batch cookies, and the bank is very muddy and steep, and if I drop them, they will tumble down this 22% grade into the waters below. So I'm clutching them to my chest and deciding whether or not I want to save this person because it will mean the loss of my cookies, right? So because I have disordered appetites, I am less free to choose what's right and good. So as the man is, so he sees. And so prudence entails ordered appetites. It has this kind of integrative function, and so it cannot exist without the moral virtues. Third and finally in this section, prudence is immediately practicable. Here again, I appeal to the Aristotelian tradition, which has a lot of meditation on practical syllogisms. But the kind of cool thing is that you have major, minor, and conclusion, and the conclusion just is action. It's not, you should do this, or you might consider doing this, or you might prayerfully think about the future option of potentially hazarding again. You know, so like, you know how we distance ourselves from actually getting in the ring. But what prudence does is it says, you're there. It puts you precisely there because the object, excuse me, the conclusion of a practical syllogism just is action. It applies cognition to affection in the very movement thereof. And here, it's just helpful for 1 second to meditate on the three aspects of prudence so you can kind of identify three stages. Counsel, where we consult our experience and memory, people wiser than us, and we take deliberate steps in rendering a good choice. And then judgment, where we actually judge regarding what is to be done and what's best, and then command, which makes the application. So when St. Thomas Aquinas talks about these three steps, he says the first two kind of need help along the way, and he describes other virtues that contribute to them. But when he talks about command, he says it needs no further help, because prudence just is identified with this last step. It is most quintessentially prudential to act, to be an agent. So, given these things, when it comes to bioethics and hard cases, we can refer back to the duty line. Whether or not it's permissible to double dip on Christmas, whether I can break the Friday abstinence fast, or what should I do in the case of this particular wedding? I would suggest to you that asking the question, what is permitted and what is forbidden, is viable. I mean, it's an option, it's licit, but it's not the whole part, it's not the whole picture. Rather, we should be asking what is true and what is good, and counseling others to do the same. So, do we want wild and woolly standards? No. I'm not advocating here for a kind of irresponsibility. We do need to make case law. There has to be a kind of casuistry, because we're always going to want to get into the details. But we should resist the temptation to focus myopically on just the hard cases, rather than, or in so doing, short-circuit what is in fact a bigger picture situation, one that implicates us in the choosing thereof. So, recovery of prudence and the virtue tradition implicates one as a protagonist and not a mere onlooker, technician, or expert. So ask not what is permissible or what is forbidden, but rather what is good and how we can attain to the truth of our lives. Thank you.